Hello and welcome to episode 31 of Speak Beastie for February 26th, 2017.
I'm Shannon.
I'm Michael.
I'm Claire.
And I'm Sophie.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Hey.
All good.
It's all good.
I always feel like we have to have something here because we usually do.
So. As previously discussed, me and Sophie are well awake because it's like two in the afternoon and it's lovely. Sorry, you can punish us with late night recordings for the rest of the year. This one, we will enjoy it.
Make the most of it. Although we do have like a wild storm going on around us.
Yeah.
It's quite
you might hear like tin cans rattling down my street.
Yeah. Wind's coming down the chimney, so it's quite noisy.
It was terrible rain yesterday. And I have a 45-minute drive to work, so I was just driving in this like you couldn't see 20 feet in front of you.
Oh god.
And I was like, well,
well, the weather continues to be perfect in Austin, Texas, where it's always the same every day.
Well, now it's fine. You know, it's 80 degrees here, so.
Well, I'm excited because I haven't even ever been on a Speak Beastie episode with Claire. When was the last time, Claire, the last time we like properly talked was it at Geeky?
I think it was at Geeky before it was Geeky. I think it was the year that Geeky became Geeky. So yeah, LeakyCon Orlando 2015? Oh no, God, it's going to be later than that. No, 14.
Oh my God.
Happy 14.
Wow.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I think we've been on a couple of staff meetings but for MuggleNet, mm-hmm. but there's never really chit-chat.
No.
Like, this is what we're doing, guys.
Finally.
But yeah.
That is why I will get up early in the morning is to talk Harry Potter with people who I haven't talked Harry Potter with yet.
Yeah. Honored. And as I was saying before, I've forgotten so much of this movie. I desperately need the DVD to come out ASAP. There's so much stuff I've forgotten. It's been like 2 months since I recorded an episode. So
when is it released, the DVD and Blu-ray?
Pretty soon.
Very soon.
March?
Soon?
Maybe.
Is it April? March?
We're great.
Well, it's good because like none of us will be getting like the preview, the review copies as well. So we're not on top of the deadlines for that. So unless you guys are keeping secrets.
March 28th.
Yeah, March 28th. Cool. Comes out soon. On digital March 7th.
I was at Target yesterday and there was a sign that was like pre-order and it was Fantastic Beasts and Rogue One. And I was like, those are the only movies I care about. So you know me so well, Target.
Ooh, and Target's going to have a special edition that's got the, like the cover looks like the suitcase. That's neat.
Oh, that's very cute. That's very good.
And it has Newt's case pop-up. And 5 character cards. Oh yeah, there's like a little pop-up suitcase that comes in. Only a Target.
That's so cute. This episode was sponsored by
Target. Target doesn't sponsor us, but hey, Target, if you want to help us out, we'd be cool with that.
Yeah, if you want to Target, that'd be great.
And now a message from our sponsor.
Stop the presses! Speak Beastie is on Patreon.com. With options ranging from $1 to $5 per month, you can become a sponsor of Speak Beastie and help us to bring you more from Newt's fantastic wizarding world. Rewards include access to bloopers and extended conversations. You can also help us decide on a discussion topic for future episodes. Check out Patreon.com/Speak Beastie to learn more and become a sponsor today.
So onto the Phoenix Register for this week. And the big news is that Fantastic Beasts won a BAFTA a couple of weeks ago. Woo! So the one, the film won Best Production Design for Stuart Craig and Anna Pinnock.
Obviously. Like, it was a really good category, actually. There was a lot of people, really good films nominated, but if it was going to win one award, it would be this. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves Stuart Craig, the whole industry adores him, and it was a stunning film. Everyone talks about how, like, they created, like, you know, completely recreated New York in the middle of Watford, which is an achievement, an absolute achievement. But yeah, so yeah, well done, Stuart Craig and Anna Pinnock.
It's very well deserved. And so it was also nominated for Outstanding British Film, which went to I, Daniel Blake, and Best Costume Design, which went to Jackie. So yeah, it was good to win one of the three.
Yeah, not surprised about British film, but Best Costume Design, those coats deserve a BAFTA.
They really do.
Damn it.
Maybe they're getting an Oscar.
Funny, yeah. Well, yeah, it's not. I was just looking at that because it's nominated for pretty much the same things at the Oscars. It's only nominated in technical categories for costume design and production design. And I think it actually has a pretty good shot at actually costume design, I think. Because it's the other thing too is I think in every category it's up against La La Land, which is tough because La La Land is gonna sweep a lot of stuff, I think.
I hope La La Land doesn't win costume because they've talked repeatedly about how they just like picked up the dresses in like random stores. It's like, that's not costume design, that's a shopping trip.
Doesn't count.
But there was a few peeps around that tweet from Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Neil exploded.
Well, talking of La La Land, Eddie also was there to present an award to Emma Stone for leading actress. So he got to go up on stage, which was nice.
He's well acquainted with BAFTAs.
Yeah.
J.K. Rowling looked fabulous, as always. She did. Her dress was amazing. Did. And there was not enough coverage of the Davids. I wasn't able to get press access, but I was sat on my bed tweeting from the Muggle.live account, and I was trying to find pictures of the cast and crew. And it was easy to find ones of Joe and Eddie, and oh gosh, her name's completely slipped in my head, but Serafina Pickery.
Carmen Ejogo.
Yeah, she was there. But then I did find a couple of people who I knew were there saying the Davids were around, but obviously the press don't care to take pictures of them, even if Haman is beautiful and should have photos taken of him. Sorry, yes.
It's not much other news, but there have been a couple of interviews released recently that have been quite interesting. So in one with Vanity Fair, Stuart Craig talked about the design for Macusa, and he said that originally the script was written that the owl in the outside decor of the building would come to life. It would animate, fly down and into the revolving doors and take visitors with it, which I just thought sounded like it would have been amazing.
Why didn't they do that?
It's so quite cool. Elaborate.
It is quite over the top, maybe. but it was cool, a little more subtle. But like, but yeah, that's quite cool.
That's cool when you think about it, because we didn't get, like, you know, a magical telephone booth or flushing down a toilet entryway. We just got a revolving door.
But I thought that design, actually, the revolving door thing was quite clever, because it so quickly, when it flipped round, I don't know, technical camera moves, but it looked like the inside of the bank that it actually is, and then flipped round, and then it became Macusa. And it was so subtle, but quite nicely done. And then you have the spectacular entrance.
It's funny when you think about it, because that is almost more designed to be a film trick. Like, if Rowling had written it that way, that would have been really boring if it was in a book. And then they went through a revolving door. Newt looked through the revolving door and saw the Woolworth building, and then you went through and it was Macusa. Magic.
Wow. I think it kind of did still call back to the Ministry of Magic, because even if the flushing of the toilet and the phone booth were a bit more jazzy, they were still like Muggle kind of tricks and use of Muggle furniture or like things in place. So a revolving door was the Muggle feature, or the no magic feature of the Woolworth building, or is the feature of the Woolworth building. And then you then get the magic as you go in. And you do get the owl a little bit, There was an owl, wasn't there? I'm sure I saw an owl.
Now that you say that, there aren't a lot of owls in it. Would like visually in the even in Makuza, you see a few around, and then we get the little their version of memos instead of the paper airplanes. They've got the little like origami mice things.
Oh, they're so cute! Yeah, they were great. Oh.
But yeah, I guess. <good. laughs> I wonder if they don't. I wonder if wizards in the U.S. actually just use the normal postal service.
I guess there could be issues with owls if they're really secure and tight on their on not being exposed. Owls could kind of be caught and exposed, especially when they're all going like bonkers and delivering like broomsticks. It's a bit more obvious.
Yeah, so in the same interview, Colleen Atwood also talked about Graves' coat, which I thought we had to bring up because we always talk about Graves, can't not. It says, Atwood described her inspiration for the admired costume of Percival Graves, legendary New York Mayor Jimmy Walker, whom she described as quite a dresser. By giving Graves a similar look but adding a sparkly coat that really pushed the period, Atwood created a combination that she called Jimmy Walker meets Joan Crawford.
Which I love. That's amazing.
Yeah. So I thought that was quite an interesting little insight into
the fabulous Graves coat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I just wish you could have seen more of the sparkles in the movie, because you see them when you see the coat up close, but I don't think you see it sparkle once in the film. Like, they could have altered that afterwards, right? A bit of post, a bit of sparkle.
They could have made it sort of glimmer a bit. That would have been good.
That's the important
thing. Stop wasting money on that amazing little niffler. Spend some time and money on making Graves' coat sparkle better.
Yeah.
It would be fabulous.
Okay, and then finally, there were 20 Fantastic Beasts concept logos that were released by Deva Studios, who designed them. Which are quite interesting to look at. They kind of all incorporate different beasts or ideas.
I love them.
They're all really different, but a lot of them I just really like. But they would have given it a very different feel, I think.
Yeah.
Some of them definitely look more childish than others. Yeah. There's some that were like really quite fat writing that reminds me of other YA films that I can't quite pinpoint right now, but there's one that looks very much like that Miss Peregrine's school for
the kind of handwriting-y one.
And there's one or two of them that remind me of the Artemis Fowl series, which I think one day is hopefully in production to be a film. A couple of them were quite similar to that, and some of them were very similar to what we actually got, just differently tweaked. But what I couldn't quite understand, were they just accidentally leaked and then quickly whipped down?
I'm not 100% sure. Yeah, it seems like they put them up and then quickly.
It was clearly Deva Studios wanting to be like, hey guys, we want the attention.
Yeah.
We got told off. Quick, pull them.
We did the logo. They didn't invite us to the BAFTAs. These are pretty cool, though.
Mm. Yeah, it's cool to see the different ideas that he came up with, but. I think I like the one they went
significantly. I think the one they got with is great because it will transition across the like the time period. What these ideas are really Art Deco, and obviously if it goes through 20 years and ends up in the 40s, unless they change the logo every time, which they could do, I guess. I think it made sense to have something that transitions a little better.
Yeah, I like those couple that are really Art Deco, but like they look like birds.
Yeah, they're cool. Yeah, with the little tail, the blue, bright blue one with the tail is really cool. I like that one. So go check that out on the website, guys.
That's it for the news this week.
I guess we'll expect more news as the books.
Hopefully as they start filming the next one. And
Which is very soon. Very soon.
Yes. And it's the Oscars next weekend, so we'll have to look out and see.
Oh, yeah.
What happens there?
It'd be interesting because I think they're definitely in pre-production, but I think like a couple of the crew will be heading to set pretty soon. I don't know if the cast are on set yet.
Dan was on a few episodes ago, he said he was getting ready to head over there soon.
Mm-hmm. So. And I think Alison was posting some photos from the UK, and she might have just been on a holiday, but I guess she's not from the UK, so possibly starting soon. So yeah, I guess we'll probably start getting some like sneak peeks, and hopefully some casting news if they actually get around to casting Dumbledore, whether he appears in this film or not. Exciting
times. Didn't J.K. Rowling tweet that they were in the process of casting him?
Yeah, I think they are. I think he's going to be in the second film.
Yeah, so she tweeted that pretty recently, so.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
That's going to have so many big discussions when they cast the Dumbledore. A new
whoever
Holy Dumbledore.
Whoever is cast, it will be a big deal.
Yeah.
Do you think they'll cast, like, someone known or, like, someone completely unknown?
Definitely known. If Grindelwald is Johnny Depp and Grindelwald in disguise with Colin Farrell, you need someone like a Brit on Johnny Depp's level, hopefully on a better level than Johnny Depp, but but like who is as famous, as well established, as, you know, known, I think also internationally.
Yeah,
so I think it's gonna be a bit of a tough one.
Yeah, Dumbledore like begs to be stunt casting. Because when he shows up, you're not only supposed to be wowed by, oh, it's Dumbledore. You're supposed to be wowed like, oh, look who's playing Dumbledore.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's it's almost certainly going to be somebody we know. Yeah.
And there'll be actors of like a certain age lining up for that role because it will be fun to play. Yeah. You know, you get to sort of like prance around as a wizard, which I think people do enjoy. But also there is so much to play with for Dumbledore that I think people will be keen. So hopefully they'll get someone good.
I wonder if they'll try to keep it a secret like they kind of did with Johnny Depp. Probably not. Probably can't try to do that again.
Also, I think if you see...
Who's going to be Dumbledore?
No one knew that he was going to be in it until that like sneak suggestion of the Deathly Hallows symbol from Graves. But yeah. Oh, I just really hope it's someone good and someone we're excited for.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Yeah, it's going to be a big year for casting, like, because they're going to be recasting Cursed Child, and then they're going to be casting the American version of Cursed Child. So there's just going to be a whole lot of chaos and controversy, and hopefully fan fun in the next 12 months.
It's all remember to get along.
Yeah, oh God, yeah. It's
but
a
yeah,
fun
let's
fandom.
Go to the main discussion.
Yeah, main discussion is... Tina or Porpentina Goldstein. So last week we discussed Queenie, I believe. So this week we're going to go to the older sister and future love interest and wife of our lead, Newt Scamander. So her full name, as mentioned before, was Porpentina, her middle name Esther Goldstein. So Porpentina Esther Goldstein, and then in the future she will become a Scamander.
I thought she couldn't get more Jewish and her middle name is Esther. I say that as a Jew. That's a beautiful name though.
Yeah.
All put together. It's funny though, because I was looking up like the origin of like and the meanings of each of her names, and Porpentina is actually is an evolution from porcupine, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, cool. And it's like from Shakespeare.
Yeah, yeah, it's very Shakespearean. She pulled a Hermione. She got a Shakespearean name.
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Are wizards just taking all their names from Shakespeare?
Well, Hermione is, I mean, it's from Shakespeare, but also originally from mythology.
That's true. Mm. Shakespeare in ancient Greece. That's where they get their names.
Yeah.
And I guess also Hermione's parents could like a bit of Shakespeare. Potentially the Goldstein did as well. So, yeah. It's quite a satisfying name to say as well with all the T's and the S's. It's quite a nice one.
Porpentina Esther Goldstein.
Yeah. And then she adds another S when she gets married. But we know her as Tina, short and sweet. She was born in August 1901, according to the ID card prop. So someone has been examining. Was that the wiki? Because I've been thoroughly reviewing the wiki.
Yeah, I found it on the wiki, and the source was the ID card prop. I thought it was interesting. It's August 1st, which is, you know, the day after Harry Potter's birthday.
Yeah. Just Jo's getting lazy. She's like, right, day after mine and Harry's. And just keep taking it.
But we don't know Queenie's birthday. So we don't know how much younger Queenie is.
Well, if my maths...
ministry ID.
Yeah. If my maths is right, potentially not, I think this makes Tina 25? Is that right? Mm-hmm. Set in 1926? Mm-hmm. Just getting very high pitches. I'm like, I don't know.
How old is Newt in the first movie?
Newt was born in 1897.
Oh.
So he's 4 years older.
Oh, maybe. Okay.
So he's, so 29 in this.
I don't know if we know how old Jacob is, like how old Jacob is in relation to Queenie. Queenie must be pretty young.
Queenie's gotta be
at least 24 or younger.
She'll be younger than 24, yeah. I was thinking when I looked at I didn't realize she was that young, and it makes a lot more sense because there's some of the way she plays it. Pretty much throughout the whole movie, you think she might be a bit older, but then at the end when she's all coy and Newt's getting on the boat, actually the fact that she's 25 makes a bit more sense.
Yeah.
And some of her like impulsive moves that we'll talk about in a bit also make a bit more sense. And I say this as like a 26-year-old, but not just being incredibly judgmental. But I think we are all slightly more impulsive as like a younger person. So I think I thought she was in her early 30s, probably because, and I've forgotten her name.
Catherine Waterston.
Oh my God. Yeah, thank you. this has been so long. I thought she was older because Catherine Waterston is that bit older.
But, how old is she? Is she in her...
She's 36.
She's 10 years older. Oh. She's got kids. Or she didn't realize.
Yeah. About to be 37.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite a gap. So as we've mentioned, she's the older sister of Queenie Goldstein and has pretty much been like, I wouldn't say necessarily carer, but looking after her sister since their parents died died of dragon pox. This is when they were young. I don't think we know much about like the age of when that happened, but it was definitely probably when they were young children. So that's pretty devastating impact. And two young sisters to lose both their parents at a young age, which probably also then definitely has that impact on how close they are as sisters that you see in the film.
I was wondering, it seems like then it might have happened before they went to school.
Possibly, yeah, because the memories in the pool are all of children. They're not of teenagers with their parents.
So they would have had to make their own way to Ilvermorny. Oh. I wonder if a Hagrid figure came and got them.
That'd be nice.
It's interesting too.
I guess that makes it.
It's interesting that they confirmed in the movie that it was dragonpox, because the dragonpox is something that a lot of people have suspected that some of Harry's relatives.
Yeah.
And including his grandparents on James's side died from, because Rowling has said that they died of a common wizard illness, and they died a little younger than wizards normally do, obviously, because otherwise they would have been around to take Harry in. So it's been a lot of people have suspected that they died of dragonpox, because apparently that's a common incurable thing in the wizarding world if you don't if you don't get the medicine in time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, it just continues with her theme, Jo's themes of orphans and loss of parents, which is just rife through all of Harry Potter. But also just multiple characters in Fantastic Beasts. We've talked about sort of Mary Lou in that whole orphanage section, but one of our protagonists to be orphans or two of our protagonists.
Well, even Newt's an orphan by this point. I think.
Is he?
His mom's not breeding fancy hippogriffs anymore.
Yeah. I think maybe she is. I thought she was dead for some reason. Let me check. maybe I just assumed she was dead because it's on everyone.
Because no one has parents.
It's Harry Potter and everybody's dead.
Well,
you look that up, because
we don't know anything about Newt's dad, but so he's probably out of his life or dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess we don't know about his mom.
Well, there you
go. That was just me assuming.
Shannon, did you put the Tina's Locket note in here? Because I'm not sure what that means.
I did not.
Oh, who did that?
Oh, not me.
I did it. I wanted to raise the question about Tina's memories, because I feel that the movie puts a lot of visual stress on her memories. It gives them a whole scene, and then there is the issue of the locket, which has kind of come to be Tina's like symbol in the series. If any of you listeners have Lego Dimensions, all of the
toys. Of course it connects to Lego.
It does. Her little toy pad has, every toy pad that the characters have has a little symbol that denotes them, and Tina's is her locket, which I thought was interesting, because it could have easily been like the Makuza symbol or something. But her locket actually kind of looks a little bit like the egg from the Triwizard Tournament. Tiny version of that egg. But I feel like there's something about Tina and Queenie's past that for some reason is maybe going to be more significant down the line.
Yeah, I think so too, because I thought that whole scene being in there and then not really being addressed again was kind of weird.
At all, yeah.
Because, like, why did you have it there?
I think the reason, main reason for that was you had to get the happy memories to lead to the memory that led to her point. So I think that was a bit of a, it was like character backstory. Oh, look, happy time with parents. And then I think, and I guess we can talk about this going straight in, that her losing her job wasn't a case of like she confronted Mary Lou. Like Newt uses the phrase, oh, you attacked her. And she says, yeah, I went for her in the front of a meeting of her crazy followers. Like went on and fully abused someone, which is, that's not just like having a go at someone because they're an abuser. Like she really went, and that's quite an impulsive move. And like frustrations and maybe like underlying frustrations or anger as a result of that. And I think by having that, you know, if you've lost your parents at a young age, or maybe in their situation, maybe there's some frustrations around that, or maybe just the responsibility of being the older sister has some kind of knock-on effect. I think it just adds a bit of like depth to her. Maybe it also makes you sympathize with her, because you're like, oh, she's so sweet. But she also attacked a muggle or a nomad. So I think it just adds to the layers that is Tina.
That's a really nice way to look at it. I kind of wish that there was something a little bit more in the movie that had connected that a little bit more. Like, as far as, I don't know. I think it might be dialogue that is missing in just a few spots, because I know there are a lot of scenes that were cut, because the more I've seen it, the more I realized kind of how a bit choppy Beasts is. And I don't think it was the fault of, I think the original, I always get the sense that the original cut filled in a lot of the gaps. So I have a feeling that there's more to that than maybe there ended up being in the movie. Because the other thing too is I'm not really sure, because as easy as it'll be to definitely make a series out of Fantastic Beasts, I could also easily have seen this, and of course that would never happen, but I could easily see this being just one movie that was it.
Because I mean, if you didn't have the whole Grindelwald thing at the end,
yeah,
and everything is pretty wrapped up.
Yeah, so I'm kind of curious as to like what other things might have been in this movie that laid the groundwork for the future four movies. so many movies.
Four more. I think because you had all that, they had to introduce that kind of parallel storyline, didn't they? So I guess probably some character development kind of got shoved to the side to make fit all that in, which, yeah.
Yeah. And I know we've talked before about feeling like Tina's character is lacking something compared to like the other characters. Mm-hmm. And maybe that was something that was there a bit more in deleted scenes and stuff.
Yeah.
I think it says something to her character. She is quite bottled up. And then she has these like outbursts, like dragging you into the Makuza or attacking Mary Lou. But generally she's quite restrained. I think whenever you get a character that's a bit more buttoned up, it just takes a while to learn more about them. And I think it's nice because actually of the four, like I think of the, by the third time I saw it, the one that I enjoyed watching the most was Jacob. He just, Dan has some amazing facial expressions and like little movements and stuff. So he's the one you like enjoy watching. But actually, I think I walked away wanting to know more about Tina, because I think I could probably, as you know, I could definitely sympathize with her more as a character than someone like Queenie, who, although fabulous, not much to relate to personally. Whereas Tina, I think, definitely ticks those slightly more reserved, probably slightly more British characteristics. But definitely there is more to her. And if like her and Newt, I think we will see, even if this film, this series does become more of a Grindelwald versus Dumbledore story, I do think we're going to get the full breadth of Newt and Tina's storyline. So yeah, that's probably why they don't need to give too much, because I think Queenie might become more sidelined as the films go on, until she's Legilimens, it becomes handy, occupancy becomes useful plot wise but I think like she'll become slightly more minor character, whereas I think we will learn more from Tina. So we had to get more from Queenie for this, for the film.
And it's like, I think even, you know, that one deleted scene we've seen of the two of them singing, you know, they didn't really say anything, they were just singing the song, but I even felt like that gave you a little bit more of Tina's character, like especially just watching her next to Queenie. She was obviously much more reserved, but it showed you like a little bit of a bubbly side to her. And Newt was like, aw, she's pretty.
I think that scene was like, if that scene had been kind of expanded on more about their past, and hadn't been more about like, look, Newt's falling in love with Tina, and it's like, yeah, we know. beat us over the head with that. We get that part already. Plus, if it had been earlier in the movie, because that was such a weird part to put like a happy song.
I'm like sad it was cut, but then I'm like, it wouldn't have worked in that.
Yeah, it would have been moment. Awful if it had been in that spot. So, but it was a nice thing to see, kind of just the two of them having like a super sistery moment. But they had such a, like, the Allison Sudon and Catherine Waterston had such good chemistry with each other that you really did believe that they were sisters. So it came off.
And they're such different characters, but you didn't feel like it was unrealistic.
Yeah,
it felt really realistic, like their sibling kind of relationship. Having a sister, I was kind of like, I see us in them. Yeah.
And you do, with siblings, you do get huge differences in siblings.
Like me and my sister are like completely different. So, yeah.
My sister's a personal trainer. Could be more different from me. I think their relationship works, and I don't think you needed more to buy that. I think that just that cooking scene. And I think also, like, a couple of people I know that went to see it that like are, you know, Harry Potter fans, they thought that like cooking scene went on too long. So I think actually if you'd put like a singing scene that like also added to that character thing, I think that would have felt like really like draggy. Whereas I think you just need that cooking scene and you kind of consolidate their relationship, that they kind of work together really well. The one's a bit more cheeky than the other. And I think you get enough, whilst also teasing more from Tina as a character. And I think the whole thing of her past and her career, like if she's 25 and she was an aura, I mean, I know there is suspicious the way that things work in the wizarding world professionally, because I think Tonks is relatively young as well. But, you know, she left school and she became an aura pretty quickly. She's obviously pretty smart and pretty on it. And that scene with her in the teapot jumping in there, quite badass.
They apparently don't go to university in the wizarding world, so they just go straight.
I mean, yeah, maybe the aura training is like 3 years, equivalent of doing like a college degree kind of thing. Yeah. So I think even if we don't, this stuff's not stated, stuff is implied, both in her performance, but also in the like glimpses of her backstory. So we know that she's got a pretty strong moral code. So she sees something that she's been told is not her business, Credence being beaten up and abused by his mother, and also the fact that this woman who runs this orphanage is like abusing all the children there. She's seeing that, and it's technically not her business. You know, she's not nomad, she's not a police officer, she is more purely for the magical community, and yet she still wants to get involved and save the kids, which I think is really sweet. But then the impulsive side of it is she actually attacked the woman, which I still think is pretty amazing. So probably I'm surprised she just got demoted, to be honest. I think that's probably quite bad. So we know that she's pretty badass, and I hope we see more of her doing some more fighting. And you know, she takes on Graves at the end, which is Grindelwald. Like, she takes on freaking Grindelwald and lives to tell the tale. She's obviously got some skill there.
Well, and I love the whole scene with the alchemy where she's like jumping around the room with the teapot.
Yeah. No, I love that. No, just like that scene is like
action hero.
Beautiful. Yeah.
It makes sense to have her.
She probably is a bit more of the action hero though, yeah.
Well, it makes sense to have her in an action role if she is an auror. Like, that's where she was, at least before that. She would be used to that kind of work. So, I actually really liked how she was kind of framed at the beginning as more of a investigator. Like her kind of like spy hijinks where she was trying to stay out of the out of sight, but she wasn't doing it very well. Like that was...
Well, just like that first shot of her where she's got, you know, her collar up and she's like looking at Newt, like she's very 1920s detective.
I was gonna say she'll do well once we get to the 40s, because then she'll be like, you know, a vice cop. Like she'll be on the beat.
But also I think that opening scene where she's kind of looking a bit shifty also highlights the fact that she knows she shouldn't be doing this. So it's quite a nice balance of like doing what she was trained to do and sort of investigating and defending, but also very aware that she's probably not supposed to be there. And she's trying not to be spotted by like Mary Lou, because Mary Lou might recognize her potentially, but also she doesn't want to be spotted by any of her fellow wizards because she's not supposed to be there. So she's looking, just she's like doubly shifty because she's just like, I know I shouldn't be here, but I want to watch it. And also conveniently placed to catch Newt.
I hate to say it because I really wanted her to be better than what she was, but honestly, Tina's better at her job than Serafina Pickery is. And I still can't get over the scenes, the two scenes that couple up with that, where she confronts Serafina and she's like, hey, this guy's breaking the law. And Serafina's like, that's great. Get out of my office. You're bothering me. And then like the later scene where she's like, you waited 24 hours. And I'm like, no, she didn't wait 24 hours. She came right to you. Trying
so
to
annoying.
Save your butt in front of the International Confederation of Wizards by blaming it on one of your aurors. That's a horrible leadership.
But also leadership that definitely happens, because I've had quite a few friends have some employment issues over the last few years, and poor management looks like that. So it was realistic, even if a bit annoying, because you've got a female president. We kind of wanted to see her be a bit cooler. But I think it was also probably potentially believable, because what we, I think, get from that, like, please just leave my office, Tina, is that she's probably kept coming up and constantly badgering and trying to get her job back. Because we don't know how long ago it was. It could have been like a year, it could have been 18 months, it could have been 2 weeks. We don't know. I don't think we know anyway.
No, I definitely got that sense, because she's clearly been like snooping around to find trouble so that she can take what she presumes to be some kind of evidence that she should be reinstated. And her, I can't remember the name of the... I think he's really cute, that her boss, that like that tiny little guy who likes Queenie. He's adorable. But he even says like, oh, were you out, you know, with the Salemers again?
Yeah.
So it's obvious that she obviously
keeps tabs on them.
Yes, she's not at her desk very often. I liked too that rather than, I'm assuming you can't you can apparate in the ministry. We've seen that. So I do love that when he, Abernathy's his name, when he comes downstairs and she just runs behind her desk. you could apparate.
Oh, well, actually, I mean, I don't want to bring it back to Graves because always, but that scene where
I think you do.
It's been 2 months. I haven't talked about it. But I think that their relationship is really interesting, because when he comes into the office to sort of like check up on her, essentially, at first it seems like there is some kind of rapport between her and Graves. And maybe that was pre-existing. But obviously, we don't know. We only have suspected how long Grindelwald is taking.
I think that's why we want to like Graves so much, is because a lot of us assume that when he was really Graves, he was probably a reasonable guy, because I mean, he seemed to be the top horror working for Serafina, kind of at her side. And that I got that sense too, that Tina wasn't afraid of him. She was actually looking to him to help her out. And
yeah,
he was playing it like he seemed like, okay, Tina, I'll give you a shot. So she didn't seem to find that unfamiliar.
It all goes back to the question of like, how long has he been Grindelwald and whatever and whatever.
Yeah, is that like, had they had a close relationship for a long time? Like, or is that something he developed? Yeah.
Just in case you're wondering, even, listeners, yeah, we're not shipping Tina.
No, Graves. Oh my god. I mean, like,
I mean, not actually, that kind of relationship. Maybe really start shipping that.
No.
Well, especially not if she's 25.
I was thinking more like, kind of Mad Eye and Tonks, kind of their
mentor kind of
relationship. Yeah,
that's true.
Well, I was thinking either Mad Eye and Tonks if he was Graves for a long time, but if he's been Grindelwald for a long time, it's almost like Mad Eye, but as Barty Crouch Jr. and Harry, because there is like a bit of a mentor relationship there. That he inspires more from him. And there's, I think Grindelwald probably would, if he sees like, you know, decent wizards, he probably would want to help them be better. Them to sort of like take them under their wing.
Another like senior decorated auror who somebody was pretending to be. We should have really seen it coming when you think about it that way.
Yeah, actually. God.
But even if he had, even if he wasn't Grindelwald for a long time, I felt like that rapport was already there. It didn't feel unnatural for him to come down and be like, "Okay, show me what you found."
Because
she seemed to be like, "Yes, I will."
I liked when she opened it and it was a bunch of pastries, and he was just like, "Oh, Tina," like,
"Yeah, she's like,
okay, not again."
This is just what happens. She comes up to the Aura offices, and Serafina's like, "Get out!" And then Graves comes down and is like, "Okay, show me."
And it's pastries every time, and the soda shit again because she's just trying to seduce him with pastries. It'd be nice though if that rapport was real, like whether it was for Graves specifically or Grindelwald, that in the future movie, in the next movie, we see some kind of, not remorse isn't the word, but like some kind of grieving process that, you know, someone
we
she
see
knew
Graves come back
and obviously that but like something from Tina that's like, I lost that connection kind of thing. Because obviously when they go head to head, she doesn't know he's Grindelwald at that point, and I think the whole arresting thing probably comes as a surprise, and the fact he essentially puts him up for execution. So I think like that, the when she realizes that, whether that will come back or whether they'll just never mention it again, we shall see.
It's like Graves for the Potter fandom is like Barb for the Stranger Things fandom. Like everybody loves them because things happen to them that were unfortunate.
Do you think if we like trend hashtag Graves lives, they'll make like a spin-off TV show about him?
Oh, I'd watch a whole TV show about him and his coats and like
I
think that'd
be amazing.
That was a good point though, Claire, what you said about kind of with Tina's relationship, because that would also explain why she's like so like that she just loses all her composure, like notwithstanding that he's like, "So you're gonna die now," but also it's like, "What are you talking about? We've worked together for years and like we've had a great working relationship, and now you're gonna kill me. That seems really unfair." Yeah, that would be interesting to examine. I have the feeling they won't. I think Graves is done with his role in the movies, unfortunately, so, but hopefully Tina isn't.
I guess on that point, like, what do we want to see from Tina? Because as we know, she does marry Newt and they live happily ever after in Dorset with pet Kneasels, and they have kids and grandkids who marry Luna Lovegood. But what do we like want to see in the next few, you know, if she is in the next four films, which hopefully she will be, what do we want to see from her?
She better hop on a ship and follow him everywhere.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
I want her to just come keep saving him.
I want, because the thing is, I'm trying to figure out like how they're going to get them back to each other if he is going to be country hopping. And the only thing I can think of is that because Newt seems to cause attention at an international level, that Serafina would send Tina to go work with him because she knows what's up.
Okay, so the movie starts. Somehow Newt gets into this wild and crazy situation, as he does. Somehow. It's really easy for him. And then, I don't know, he's about to do something stupid. And then Tina just, like, pops up out of nowhere and saves him. And he's like, what are you doing here? And she's like, I just sensed that you were doing something stupid.
No, she'll be like, Queenie sensed you were doing something stupid.
Yeah, Queenie sensed you were doing something stupid. Oh, she's here, by the way. And Queenie and Jacob come out from around the corner and they're like, hey. And he's like, Jacob, you remember everything. And Jacob's like, of course.
Brought you some pastries.
Yeah.
That we cooked together in our shop that we co-own.
Yeah, we're married. You this haven't been writing us fanfic, letters, guys. Newt. We would have told you all this.
That was easy. We could write a film script. We got this.
Yeah.
Maybe we've just like overworked it and they're just in Paris for a romantic weekend away. Maybe it's already happened and he whisks her off.
Yeah.
And then Lida Lestrange pitches up because we kind of know the summary of the next film, right? Well, bits of it anyway. We know that Lida Lestrange pitches up. So we're probably going to get some love triangle nonsense going on.
I don't want that.
Oh, dear.
I hope Lida just comes and she's just like, she pitches up and like it's all a bit awkward initially, but then she's like, no mate, it's Grindelwald, and there's just nothing there, and the girls get on and they deal with it. And like, that'd be great. That'd be so good.
I think Lida should come in and Newt should be like, oh my god, my lost love, and Lita's like, I'm gay.
Yes.
And he's like, oh, okay, well then, never mind.
That, you know, because that's the other, when we were talking before about things that are built up for the next film, like I'd say the things that were built up for the next film are obviously Grindelwald, Credence, and Leela, and Lida Lestrange. So she's probably going to be the other big thing. And I'm curious because they've, you know, obviously since she's a Lestrange and they set her up with Queenie saying like, oh, isn't her family kind of, ooh. Like, that's exactly what she said. I'm curious if she going to be, like, involved with Grindelwald stuff. Is that just how they're going to end up establishing her involvement and she's going to kind of just draw Newt in and then backstab him or something like that?
I really hope not.
I just don't know why they're even so intent on involving Newt in Grindelwald stuff. Like, it's so funny to me that, like, Newt wouldn't bother to say in his giant foreword, like, oh, also, I defeated the greatest wizard of all time.
Yeah.
Just FYI.
Well, I feel like his connection to Grindelwald is more his connection to Credence and Obscurials. And Grindelwald is going to keep chasing after.
After that Obscurial.
The Obscurus.
Because he wants it so bad. Yeah. I guess that would make.
So.
They're both going after the Obscurus. Then,
so that's my hope, is that Lita is definitely not evil. Really don't want that, but that she's just like hanging out in Paris or whatever, and kind of gets wrapped up in it all.
But I think she could definitely be. I thought that she could definitely be wrapped up with Grindelwald and not be evil, because Grindelwald is not good. But some of the things he believes in, people could support and not be evil, but they just get bit persuaded by the wrong things. And maybe she's like coming to realize this. Maybe that's what the film's about.
Or maybe she's like an Auror in France and she and Tina bond over being Aurors.
Yeah. And then they just gossip about Newt all the time. He's like, what's going on?
Yeah.
I guess it would make
No.
It could potentially work if Tina's with him by that point, because the end of the film suggests that he's going to go back to the UK and immediately publish Fantastic Beasts, and then he said he's going to bring it back to her in person. So between this film and the first film and second film, he's ostensibly gone to the UK and then back to the US.
Yeah, because we have no idea how much time is going to pass.
Yeah, a few years might have passed, so it might be like 4 years later or something.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we know this. I feel like J.K. Rowling says something about
this
recently.
Do we know it? Oh, okay.
Well, I think
maybe.
Another news site that I couldn't possibly mention falsely reported that it was due to, like, it was going to pick up like a few days later. And I think J.K. Rowling tweeted me like, it's not.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it was implied maybe months as opposed to years. I can't imagine it'd be, but then, like, if they're going to get to the 1940s,
but they've got,
they're going to have to, like, jump
20
play, like,
years
five
to cover. Yeah.
Yeah.
I could see it being a few years and he still hasn't gone back to the US. And then Tina pops up and is like, "You never brought me my book." And he's like, "Oh, I was going to get around to it.
I had to buy a copy from Macy's."
Yeah. And, like, "You're really pretty and I'm kind of scared of you." And.
At some point, though, Tina's obviously got to, cause she ends up living in the UK with Newt, doesn't she? So she's got to, like, leave Macusa. So she might just be like, "I've quit. I've come to, like, be with you." Or she might, I don't know, go international.
I think we'll get, like, a really exciting plot line in which she has to get, like, a magical visa and we see, like, the paperwork that goes into that. It must be really easy for wizards just, like, pop around town and or different countries and just be like, "There's..." But yeah, there has to be a point in those 20 years where they get married, have children, and settle down in Dorset.
Well, and potentially she has, their family has relatives in the UK because Anthony is related to them distantly. So she might have family already in Europe that she'll reunite with too.
Basically, we've got no flipping idea. And we've just got a vague
idea.
Made
all that up. The news is slow.
As long as we don't get some, like, awkward love triangle and Leda and Tina don't get on. If they don't get on because Leda's evil, then that's one thing. But if they don't get on because they're, like, squabbling over Newt, then that'll just be
really I think I'd really hate that because this first movie at least did a great job with not making Queenie and Tina just there for love interests. Like, they had Queenie suffered a little more from that than Tina did, but the two of them overall had more of a role in the plot than just being there to just be as my favorite internet reviewer, the nostalgia chick Lindsay Ellis, calls it, the sexy lamp, where it's just, they're not the sexy lamp. They don't just stand there and look pretty, and they're not just there for the boys to ogle at.
Well, and as much as, like, Queenie is more of a love interest, it didn't feel outside of her character. Mm-mm. Like, she is content with being a love interest. Like, it didn't feel like, why is she being the love interest all the time when she could go be kicking ass like Tina?
Yeah, she still did, like, she rescued them from the
Queen's
and stuff, so she still did, like, important stuff. Mm-hmm. She wasn't just...
Well, so you can be, like, a passive love interest in a movie, or you can drive that romance, and I'd say she was the driver of that. Like, he fancied her because she looks like that, but then, like, she was the one who, like, drove that relationship, so she was very much in control of that. Also, I think the fact that we've got Joe writing this is, like, you know, yes, we've got two series where it's lead men leading it, but... her women aren't always... I don't think there are any women that are just love interests, so I think we can be safe that that's not...
Rose Weasley!
Alright, well...
Who?
It's Cursed Child, it doesn't count.
Oh, well, she didn't write that, it's fine.
She didn't write that.
She was there, she was watching.
I was like, who is this character? But I can't remember. Yeah, no, that's a whole other story.
You wiped it.
Nobody remembers, that's all she was there for.
Oh,
poor Rose.
A little sidetrack. This is a massive sidetrack, but we can cut it out. It's really cute. I know you guys don't particularly like it, but Sophie will appreciate this. I went to the What's on Stage Awards, and they Kershaw won everything because some fans liked it. And Anthony Boyle and Noma both had, like, just finished the show, and they ran like loons to get there because they, like, the show finished at like 9:10, and the What's on Stage Awards were finishing around that time, and they conveniently had their awards at the very end of the night. Who was going to win that? But they turned up, and Anthony jumped on stage, and he was just like, oh my God, I've just run here and I saw John Tiffany, the director, outside, and I just knocked his award, which are glass awards, out of his hand, and it shattered everywhere. And he just smashed it, completely smashed it. So he was like, mate, this is yours, like literally yours. And as he got off the stage, he was just like on his one knee, like giving the award to this director.
Oh my God.
He's just broken everything.
Oh, that's adorable.
It was very cute. Very, very cute. Anyway. Back to Fantastic Beasts.
There's one more big thing. I think we had a note about Tina.
Or... yeah.
Her wand, I think.
Yeah.
Is that that? Or, yeah. So I looked into a bit about this.
We don't know like what it's made out of or anything.
Yeah, so we don't know what it's made out of, but the wiki does some good investigations. Thank you, wiki. And the filmmakers, and I'm not sure who it was that said this, but they commented that it was functional and more understated, which I guess... this is still kind of, we don't know exactly when the wands were made or they received them like when they're younger, but ornate wands I still think are a bit bonkers considering like the history of Harry Potter. You just get your wand. It's not really related to like how you are as a person when you're 25. But being like understated, it does make more sense for her. Like it's just quite functional. I quite liked that the wiki sort of compared it to a similar design for Harry's wand in the first movie.
Yeah.
It's very, very simple. Yeah. Probably like in the first movie, they weren't thinking, oh, ornate wands that we can sell.
In the first two movies, all the wands look the same, and Tina's wand looks like those wands, which actually is a little closer to what's implied a wand looks like in the books.
Yeah.
So she's got more of a canon, quote unquote, wand, I would say.
And it kind of works with her outfit, like it's, you know, sort of straight lines and just very like functional, which is quite good. And again, Wiki being on it with their investigations, they said it being simple and sleek design implied that it could be a Diego Quintana wand, which could potentially imply that it's a White River monster spine. Core.
We'll talk more about the White River monster in the nude case later.
I was about to be like, wasn't there an episode of Alohomora where Michael was like, they should talk about the White River monster?
So I came over here and decided to take care of that.
Yeah.
Well, and
oh my gosh, I didn't realize that. I hadn't actually scrolled down when I got that information. That's amazing.
Well, because about that, because if it is, because Thiago Quintana ones, I guess it's implied still exist, but they're not made of White River monster spines anymore, at least by the time that Tina would get a wand. The other thing too is that by this time I still think kiddos who go to Ilvermorny are getting their wands at Ilvermorny, if that tradition has still held up.
Yeah.
They don't
I mean the logistics of that are still a bit weird.
yes, they're a little odd. They don't go shopping like the UK wizards do for their wands, I guess.
I don't know.
But yeah, it'd be nice to get more information. And I guess we should wrap up on Tina to say that she's a Thunderbird, which we didn't know from the films. And in fact, Catherine Waterstone and, actually none of them knew their houses when I interviewed them for the media roundtables for Fantastic Beasts. So it's nice that JK did finally confirm that. Although I'm a little bit disappointed because I'm not a Thunderbird and I wanted her to be a Thunderbird. I mean, I wanted her to be a Pugwudgie like me. But yeah.
Queenie's a Pugwudgie.
We guessed those correctly, though.
Yeah. I think it's pretty good assessment, I think, based on what we know.
Thunderbird is soul and adventurers, which I definitely see for her.
Yeah, I think the soul, I think relating her to soul, the soul connection, I think is nice. I think that definitely makes
sense. I love, too, that they're not in the same house, her and Queenie.
Yeah.
I'm glad that she did that, because I don't think we had thought that they would have been in Pugwudgie and Thunderbird and not in the same house. So I like that. Mm.
Yeah, because even though they've got the similarities, as we said before, they are different enough and have their virtues are slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense. We have a Thunderbird in the team.
Yeah, there's a Thunderbird, I think, outside of one of your houses, too. I hear the Thunderbird.
I think that might be Sophie's house and the chimney.
Oh yeah,
there's
yeah,
a Thunderbird in chimney. Your chimney.
Yep.
It is so windy. I went for a walk at lunchtime and it was generally like, you know, when the wind is just coming at you and you can't quite stand up straight. Yeah. I was like walking into, like diagonally walking into it. I was like, what the hell? It's like really sunny, but you get outside and it's like, whoa.
And I could hear all the trees like creaking above me. I went out and I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be crushed. Oh, scary. Yeah, it's quite noisy. Sorry.
That's fine.
And so ends Porpentina Goldstein.
Yay.
So for the time turner today, we're going to go further back in time than we usually do, because I'm running out of things to talk about from the 20s. We'll get into the 30s eventually, but like we got a couple years to do that. So I thought we should talk about, because Fantastic Beasts is going from New York to Paris, then we should look at something that is a connection between those two cities. So the Statue of Liberty was an idea by a French person. Let's see if I can say
which
this.
A lot of Americans would prefer to forget that that's a fact, but it is a fact.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I loved reading about the Statue of Liberty for this. Okay. Edouard René Lefebvre.
He needs more vowels really, really in close. His name.
De La Volée, something like that.
Edouard René Lefebvre de La Volée. Sorry, France. Nobody from France is listening to the show anymore.
Anyway, let's just call him Ed.
So, a friend of mine listens to it. She's half French. She'll be writing in.
Ed was president of the French Anti-Slavery Society. Yeah. What? And he was a supporter of the Union in the Civil War, as you might guess from him being president of the Anti-Slavery Society.
Yes, kudos to you, Ed.
So it's not exactly clear like when he came up with the idea and why, but he was like, hey, we should like have some sort of monument in the U.S. to remind them of their great recent accomplishment of abolishing slavery, because the Civil War had just ended. And also, it'll show the people of France that, like, freedom and democracy are great. And so he just kind of suggested it to his friend, Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi. Fred. And Fred was like,
Fred and Ed.
That's a great idea. So then he decided that he was going to make it, because he was a designer. So, there's a lot of things that went into the design of the Statue of Liberty. So it's kind of based on the image of Libertas, who is a Roman goddess of freedom, often associated with emancipated slaves in Rome. And she was used a lot on American coinage at the time, and she was on the Great Seal of France. So it was a good connection between the two. She holds a torch, which represents progress as well as light. She wears a diadem, which has 7 rays, so it looks like a halo, but it also represents the 7 seas, 7 continents, and again, light, because she is enlightening the world.
She's trying.
Yeah, she's trying. He considered having her hold a broken chain, but then he was like, that might be a little bit too divisive so soon after the Civil War. So instead, and I didn't know this, the chain is at her feet, and it's like half covered by her robe. And so the broken chain is still there, but you just can't like see it in most pictures of the Statue of Liberty because it's like on the platform.
Shame that he decided to hide it, because it seems like that's another really important detail about her that people would prefer not to think about.
Yeah. So you should Google like Statue of Liberty chain, and then you can see lots of pictures of it. So it kind of like goes from her front foot underneath her robe and comes out like later. And there's like a broken link. So she has broken free. And then she's holding a tabula ansata. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong too.
Sounded like, nice.
I said it with confidence. So.
That's right.
And so that also harkens back to Rome because it's like a Roman thing and it evokes the law and it's inscribed with the Roman numerals for July 4th, 1776 because Declaration of Independence. And we call it the Statue of Liberty, but it was actually named Liberty Enlightening the World. It was all about enlightenment. And so took a long time to like get it built and stuff. People who were working on it kept dying. And so he finished like the head and the torch first, and they were displayed at various places. So like the head was displayed at the Paris World's Fair in 1878. And it was pretty soon after that he got the help of Gustave Eiffel. Might recognize that name. He built a little thing called the Eiffel Tower. And then finally, they brought it over to America and put it all together. And it was dedicated on October 28th, 1886. President Grover Cleveland presided over it. There was a little parade. They went through New York. And this was actually the start of ticker tape parades, where people throw ticker tape out the windows. So they just kind of spontaneously did that for this parade. And then it became a whole tradition.
That's cute.
And then
there's also quite a few replicas of the Statue of Liberty, specifically one in Paris, which when I first went down the River Seine a few years ago, we went with work and we were having a river cruise dinner thing. Very good. And sort of turned around and there was the Statue of Liberty, much smaller.
Yeah.
The American one. There's also one in Odaiba in, I think that's how you say it, Odaiba in Tokyo, which I saw last year. Also much smaller. And just it's just really strange because it's such an icon of the United States to see it like randomly elsewhere with different backdrops.
Well, yes, and the United States really makes a point of not letting you forget that she's our icon. But at the same time, we really work hard to not live up to any of the values she stands for these days, unfortunately. So, yeah, she's an interesting figure because we're like really proud that we've got her. But we don't want to talk about where she came from or what she stands for. She's just a nice
the
statue.
The French gave it to us to celebrate ending slavery.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Hooray for Lady Liberty. And she even gets her little moment in Fantastic Beasts.
When
Newt comes into New York. So she's there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I think Gustave Eiffel was a wizard. Because...
Sure.
The only way you can be building all of these crazy things and moving all this crazy stuff across countries is if you're a wizard.
Can't, yeah.
Yeah. There's the tie in there. Newt's going to meet Gustav Eiffel.
And that would be like, amazing.
There is some crazy beast in my Eiffel Tower.
He just hangs out in the Eiffel Tower.
Oh. Something needs to climb up the Eiffel Tower. Something slightly bigger than a Niffler.
King Kong. Riff something on King Kong.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's what we want.
He died in 1923, so unfortunately.
Oh, no.
He was 91 years old.
Oh, okay. Well, that was a mercy then for him. that was quite an age to reach at that in that time period. Wow.
Yeah, good for him.
Well done, Gustav.
Wait, is Bartholdi still alive now, you know, in 2017? Frederick August?
Bartholdi.
Why are there so many people named Frederick? Okay, oh, he died in 1904.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, he's definitely dead.
So it seems like Newt won't be meeting any of these people.
Yeah. Because I know the guy who had the idea died while the statue was being built, which sucks.
Will Newt like see a tiny Statue of Liberty in Paris and be like, "Oh yeah, I've been there." Yeah,
he'd just be on the river,
just like Claire.
He's like maybe he's riding something. Yeah, he'd be on a cruise having a dinner.
Oh, you have these here too.
That would be so funny if the movie started with just Newt on a river cruise.
Exactly the same shot, time. But a different scale.
Every movie starts with Newt on a boat.
I like it. And ends with
if that means, and also, but like with the Statue of Liberty behind it, which means just go all to the different replicas, and that means he could go to Japan, which would be great.
That would be really cool.
the new Fantastic Beasts needs to go to Japan. I haven't actually been on an episode in a while, and I just wanted to say, Shannon, have you noticed that Pottermore totally stole your time turner idea?
What?
They've started doing like throwback articles. When I saw that, I was like, okay, come what? On, guys. Fess up.
You get it. You listen.
Oh.
Wow.
They're listening.
Oh, I did make me chuckle.
Oh. Now I gotta go. Yeah. Look at
Pond. That was a nice connection. We need to find some new American and Paris connections because that'd be a good one.
Yeah.
So we fuse them together.
All right. So are we coming back to our time period so we can open up the new case? There we go. Thank you. That's the sound it makes in the Cursed Child stage show, right? Like everybody just turns the time turn in the office. They all go. the effects are truly astounding.
Just all the actors on stage, like walking backwards.
Of all the effects in that show, though, the time travel bit is the one that I'm saddest people who haven't seen it haven't seen, because it is astonishing.
I'm sure.
It's quite something.
For now, I'm just going to keep picturing the... I like that.
Amazing.
Especially with the little dance routines they do and the dancing staircases. I think that'd be great.
But now we are poised in front of the newt case. Let's open it up. And what jumps out? A giant white river monster.
All right. Well, maybe close that newt case then.
Yeah. Let's go inside and go into it and explore its habitat a bit.
Okay.
Its full name is the White River Monster of Arkansas. We are specifically talking Arkansas because it was sighted around Newport in the White River, which is located in northeastern Arkansas. Major sightings occurred in 1915, 1937, and 1971. I'll leave it to you listeners to find a pattern there, because I can't. They're all odd numbers. There you go. But there's also a suspicion that its actual first appearance might have been prior to 1915 during the Civil War, and that it overturned a supply ship. But nobody really has an account of, like, a proper account of what happened with that one. So that one's a little hard to count. Supposedly, though, its appearance is that it has, most people note its skin, which is kind of loose and elephant-like. It is around, somebody said it was around the size of 5 feet long by 12 feet wide, while somebody in 1915 said it was like one car long by 3 cars wide or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, they didn't have good measurements, I guess, by that time. Something like that. Couldn't eyeball that very well. It supposedly, in some accounts, has the face of a catfish. In other accounts...
These are the pictures.
These pictures are pretty weird. It also has in some accounts, including the 71 account, it has a bone coming out of its forehead. The 71 account also noted three-toed tracks that were about 14 inches wide, that were kind of like coming off of the river, and there were like trees that had fallen around that area to make it look like it was quite large. There have been multiple attempts to capture it, find it in the like deep sea diving to find it and see it, and even kill it. And they've all failed. There was quite an effort in 37 after that sighting. They tried multiple things. In 1915, they actually tried to build a giant net, but they ran out of money. So they just gave up.
It sounds like trying to capture Loch Ness Monster.
Well,
and that's what's
yeah. Well, like if you actually search the White River Monster in Google, which I might have done just now, there are a lot of pictures of the Loch Ness Monster. And I don't know whether that's like comparisons.
No, I think
I think it was like considered their Arkansas.
Oh yeah, this is definitely like America so badly wanting to have a Nessie that they kind of.
I love this one picture has a caption that's like, could the White River Monster be nothing more than an unusually large alligator snapping turtle? I'm like, probably.
Well, it's actually believed by scientists to have been an elephant seal. Which pretty much matches the skin and the size. I feel like, you know, sometimes when people, of course, when people get let their imaginations run wild, they say things like, "Oh yes, it totally had a face like a catfish. It had a bone protruding from its forehead." No, it didn't. You're crazy. But scientists still can't really account for if these were all sightings of the same animal. They can't account for why this animal would have lived so long, other than that if it had no predators around, because it was out of its normal area, it could have potentially lived a longer lifespan. And why an elephant seal would even end up there, because they are not remotely native to that part of the world. But the other thing too is that in 73, 2 years after the last major sighting, there was a state legislature signed Senator Robert Harvey's bill into law, which actually created a refuge for the White River Monster, and you are not allowed to hurt it in a certain area of the river.
Arkansas is crazy. Yeah. I used to live there, I can say that.
Yeah, no, it's there you go, it's fair. As was previously mentioned when we were talking about Tina's wand, the spine bones from the White River Monster, the way that Rowling incorporated into her mythology is that the spine bones from it are used as cores by American wand maker Thiago Quintana. And in that piece, Rowling actually suggested that multiple White River Monsters exist, and that Quintana's use of their spine bones was actually leading to a concern that they were going to become extinct. But Quintana apparently was the only person who knew how to lure them over to him to get what he needed from them. And upon his death, White River Monster One ceased production. What I thought was interesting was that you guys already, just with that summary, kind of brought up that this is very comparable to Nessie, which is funny because in Rowling's mythology, Nessie is a Kelpie. I kind of thought it was funny that she didn't suggest that the White River Monster is a Kelpie, because it's kind of the same exact idea. But she did specifically call it the White River Monster of Arkansas, capitalized. So it could potentially be a Kelpie, but she didn't. But she was saying that its spine bones are used, and so that seems to be very specific to, like, that monster. You can't just take a spine bone from any Kelpie. But I thought that was interesting that she chose not to merge.
So, I looked up elephant seal whilst you mentioned it, and they are the weirdest looking creatures. And I think if you saw one of them and you'd never seen one in your life, you'd think they were magical. They are so weird. And fighting, they are really gross. So I think back in the day when they didn't have much to do and they were drinking much stronger alcohol and it was dark, I can see how this was created into mythology.
Look at their funny noses. Yeah.
Why do they always look so mad?
Stupid noses. If you actually click on the elephant seal fight, it's really gross. There's lots of like blood all over them as they've fought nearly to their death and they're ripping each other's trunks off. Nice creatures.
Yeah. I could buy that if that's how their general behavior is. But I suppose if Nude ever ends up back in the U.S. and goes to Arkansas to see them, I guess it would be interesting to see if the filmmakers would use an elephant seal as their basis for what it would look like, or if they'd just go crazy with this one. But it's interesting because it's like so set off as its own beast when it could have easily been bled into Rowling's mythology even further, but she actually chose to kind of leave it as its own thing.
Which I quite like. I like that she sort of finds the other monsters that have just come out of, like, I mean, it's not even mythology, is it? It's just legends of just monsters in areas. And I like that she's looked around the world to find those ones.
Wow, elephant seals are
one of the
huge,
safer ones. That, yeah, no, they're really gross.
They are like the size of cars.
So it could have been.
I feel like this section always makes me discover like really horrible real animals. They're just more alarming than the Fantastic Beasts. Just
terrible. It's funny because before I chose the White River Monster, I was planning to do Streelers, which are giant snails.
Oh my god!
So I know a lot of weird facts about snails now and their place in history. Next time. So, but we've spent our time in the Newt case, and you know, we've gotta leave the White River Monster elephant seal to his playtime in his
giant, that's probably for the best,
in his giant pool that we knew built him in the case.
It's full of blood.
He doesn't have another one in there, I think, right? Okay. I'd imagine if Newt kept...
because he savagely murdered him.
I feel like if Newt kept these, he would make two different pools for them. He wouldn't let them share probably. A space.
Oh, maybe they'd have like the bubble pool that the Grindelwald has, which I really love that so much. This is just like swimming around.
Can you imagine, though, if wizards must consider a White River Monster spine wand to be extremely valuable if there is one still intact out there, because they're not made anymore.
And how do you get a spine bone from a White River Monster?
Well, I was wondering.
What are your secrets, Thiago?
I was wondering if she was going along with the idea of since the 71 account mentioned that it had a bone protruding from its forehead. I was wondering if she was kind of envisioning that it actually had bone, like kind of exposed bone along its back or something like that. And that's where she might have gotten that from. I don't really know how she's picturing it. I'm assuming it's not, it doesn't look like an elephant seal in Rowling's head. But yeah, I'm assuming because there was a concern about extinction that Quintana was killing them to get their spine bones.
So no more of that. Have a lot of spine bones though, so you could make a few wands from one.
There you go. But yes, the White River Monster is no longer endangered in the wizarding world.
It is. We don't need to touch him.
Yes, and then the nomad just went and put a legislation out that he can't be harmed anyway. So
that's nice.
It all worked out.
Cool. So to wrap up this week, we want to hear from you about our main discussion, Tina. What would you like to see from her in future films, or what was your favourite moments from this film? What would you like to discover more about her character as we go further into the series? Send us your fantastic theories, comments, questions, anything really, but particularly about Tina. And we'd love to hear from you, so drop us an owl or on any form of social media outlet, which we'll go through later, or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. Thanks.
So listeners can now find all of our episodes at www.speakbeastie.com. The website features all of our episodes, and soon we will have a shop forum and a specialised area where you can learn more about the beasts we cover on the show. So make sure to look out for that soon. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at speakbeastie, Facebook at facebook.com/speakbeastie, and Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com.
I love that on our website, on the team page, there's like a collage of a bunch of us, and it's mostly just us wearing like Speak Beastie shirts and usually in front of a Fantastic Beast sign being like, yay! And then it's Michael dressed as Graves looking really intense. Like, none of us are as cool.
No, we need to up our cosplaying game, guys.
Yeah. Yes, join me. It's more fun on this side.
I'm Shannon.
I'm Michael.
I'm Claire.
And I'm Sophie. Case closed.
Thank you.
Shannon, did you put the Tina's Locket note in here? Because I'm not sure what that means.
I did not.
Oh, who did that?
Oh, not me.
Michael? No. Have we lost Michael? I think we've lost Michael.
We've lost Michael. Oh, no.
Dropped. Oh, no. Okay.
Oh, no.
Wow.
Do you think this is a mighty producer popping something in as a prompt, thinking we might know what they're talking about? I know she had a locket, but was there anything particular about it?
Hello, am I back?
Hello.
Yes, you're back.
Yeah, you're back.
Oh, that was weird. That was really scary. I usually know when it's happening when I'm getting dropped from a call because I'm talking and everybody's like, Michael? Michael? What did you... Michael! It always happens right before a point that I've put in the dock.
Oh, is it... It was Tina's Locket, your point?
Yeah, Tina's Locket and the stuff about her parents was my point. Yeah.
Cool. Go for it.